production produced by the stations of the National Campus Community Radio Association. Till next week, and welcome to the September 30th edition of Dromos Text. Today, of course, is the day of truth and reconciliation. In celebration of that day, we're playing a one-hour lecture by the poet Joy Harjo, we've heard often on the show. She's an American poet, musician, playwright, and author, and she's the incumbent United States Poet Laureate and the first Native American to hold that honor. Harjo is a member of the Muscogee Nation and belongs to Hickory Ground. She's an important figure in the second wave of the literary Native American Renaissance. So, without further ado, here's Joy Harjo.
People like our live classes. It's a little bit more raw and organic.
Sorry. I knew this might be a problem. It's not a virus. I'm going to try to go right through it, okay? I'm Stephen Yenser, and from the UCLA English Department, which has been a sponsor of this series for a long, long time, almost as many years as it's been going, but it began 50 years ago, and tonight kind of marks that 50 years, in the Sunset Canyon Recreation Center on campus, thanks to the ingenuity and the indefatigability of Doris Curran, who really invented the series and is responsible for everything really that's happened on poetry at UCLA ever since. Thank you. And what happens these days is really the in the bailiwick of Claudia Bester, who runs all the programs at the Hammer somehow, 350 of them a year or something. You know, so she's something. She only has two hands. I don't know how she does it. You're a great audience. Thank you. So this is 50 years right now, or we're going to call it that. It's a little fuzzy. But it's fortuitous, I think, that this is 50 years for us. How so, you ask? Well, the series began in the heyday of the American Indian Movement, AIM. And as many of you know, the movement was founded in 1968, and before long, the movement had occupied Alcatraz for a time, and then went on the next year to raise a ruckus at Mount Rushmore, which is, of course, in ancient sacred Lakota territory in South Dakota. Then in 1972, they sponsored the Trail of Broken Treaties Caravan, which went cross-country from San Francisco to Washington, D.C., and it was made up of vans and, you know, VW bugs and motorcycles and I think anything else that they could get to roll them over in protest. But we might locate the center of all that activity on Thanksgiving Day in 1970, so that would be 50 years for that, too, when, as the ceremony honoring the, too many numbers here, 350th anniversary of the Pilgrim's Landing at Plymouth Rock, the Indian movement captured the replica of the Mayflower, which was on display up the road in Boston. And so that was a huge, huge event. I see that did I leave something out? I think I probably did. I left out maybe half intentionally the the tragic takeover of a wounded knee in the middle of all that. But anyway, now it has been 50 years since that Thanksgiving, or the first National Day of Mourning, as some American Native Americans like to call it. So we can have tonight a kind of double semi-centennial. And to mark the occasion, we're delighted to be lucky enough to have with us the first Native American poet laureate, Joy Harjo. Joy reminds us in her most recent volume of poems that it's been even more recently that Congress got around to passing the Indian Religious Freedom Act, which finally made it legal for Native people to enjoy their cultural customs freely. Do you know it was not until 1978 that that act was passed? And conceivably, as Joy observes in passing, that could have been... The previous law could have prohibited the reading of songs and stories having to do with the tradition, but now finally the act was passed and Joy can appear here tonight to recite her work, which has its roots, of course, untold in untold centuries previous to us. Without any, she can be here tonight without any fear of legal intervention anyway. So I have no idea how those original songs must sound, but Joy does. And on the evidence of her own work in English, I'd have to guess that these songs were direct and emotive and must have involved some improvisation, must have invited immediate assent and even participation. They must have something in common, I think, with jazz. The invention, if I mean that's not the right word, since it didn't come about that way, but the beginning of jazz, which of course the product of another essential and long disenfranchised American culture. And jazz is the other art that Joy, and other art anyway, that Joy practices, and maybe we'll get to hear a bit tonight, I don't know, at least partly because her grandmother played the saxophone back around 1900. Joy has her own bear cannon, as some people call that instrument. I don't know if she has it tonight, but I saw that she had something that makes noise with her. She writes in American Sunrise, she says, "The saxophone is so human. Its tendency is to be rowdy, edgy, talk too loud, bump into people, say the wrong words at the wrong time. But then," and she's continuing, "you take a breath all the way from the center of the earth and blow. All that heartache," and she must have in mind her Indian heritage as well as African-American history, "all African-American history, all that heartache," she said, "is forgiven. All that love we humans carry makes a sweet, deep sound, and we fly a little." I should just stop there, but I'm going to take it one step further and quote another wonderful Midwestern American poet, Howard Nemiroff, who wrote once, "The greatest poetry sees clearly and says plainly the wickedness and terror and beauty of the world, while at the same time humming to itself so that we overhear rather than hear, all will be well." Joy Harjo.
Thank you for that introduction. And I was thinking, I've been telling everybody I've been writing for 50 years, and we were sitting there figuring this out, and it's 47 years. So I guess I'll have to have a party in a few years. Although this year's been quite a party. But actually, one of the highlights of this year was getting to talk with Wayne Shorter, not once, but twice. Yeah. So I want to start with a song to acknowledge the original people of these lands, the Tongva, and there are other groups, I'm sure, but I know them. And because they're still here and still present, we're not in the past tense. In fact, I'm going to meet with a young Tongva poet tomorrow in Irvine, I think tomorrow morning. I don't know where I'll be after. Yeah. So, but we're very present. And to honor the keepers of the land, you may not know that, I mean, you have such incredible plants, and I did spend a few years here, and yet, you know, Los Angeles, this big metropolis, is gigantic, and what I liked about it are all the small communities, but there are plants, you know, there's the desert plants, and then there's the plants that are always making themselves known, like the orange plants. That smell of orange I associate with ocean all mixed in together. But somebody takes care of those. Yeah, we have the keepers, a lot of them native people, even from the south. And, you know, and the keepers that you don't see. Some people can see them, you know, and the ancestors of this place. It's like every place has ancestors, the plants have ancestors, and poems have ancestors. Every poem has a poetry ancestors. But this is in honor of the ancestral keepers of this beautiful place, which takes care of so many people and continues to take care of so many people. So when I say Mado, thank you. Mado, 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 Mado. Because of the introduction, I am going to start with a poem that I hadn't planned on starting with, because I started writing poetry out of Native rights movements. I was a student at the University of New Mexico and part of the Kiva Club, which was the Native Student Club. It was set up as a social organization, and then we quickly became kind of the central station for justice for Native peoples. in our communities, you know, which were all around New Mexico, and then it includes Oklahoma. Often I was the only person not from New Mexico. recently I was on a call with some alumni, and I was the only non-Navajo or Pueblo on that call. But this poem was one of those poems written out of those stories that we were collecting, gathering, and being part of, because it's really Native justice for Native people is just like justice for, you know, African Americans, Black Lives Matter, and so it's justice for everybody. You know, ultimately we're one person. It's justice for everyone. But it's for Alva Benson and for those who have speaked. Alva Benson was a young Navajo woman I admired greatly. I didn't say much. I never said much of anything, but I kept notes. But I listened, and I remember she would stand up in meetings and talk, and often she'd be the only young woman standing up and talking. I went to poetry. And even though I was an art major, I was painting, because that's what I grew up doing, art. And poetry came to me in those quiet hours after I was painting, and I would sit there quiet with my children asleep and thinking about all the stories we'd been hearing, and then women's reality, which was a little different because we were holding up other parts of the world. And she died very young, tragically, but she was always out there. She had a good heart and had a great love. That's what I admired in her, was her great love for the people and for the land, because we're not separate. So in honor of all of those people who, you know, this is, we're, you know, and we still meet, and we're all part, you know, that's all part of how I came to be here. That's what threads through my poetry. Also, when I started writing poetry, I was studying Navajo, and I actually got pretty good in it. I started dreaming in Navajo language. But that language, you know, and I'm learning my own Muscogee language, but that language being there wasn't just English, but it was also that Navajo that became part of the beginnings of my poetry. For Alva Benson and for those who have learned to speak. And the ground spoke when she was born. Her mother heard it. In Navajo, she answered as she squatted down against the earth to give birth. It was now when it happened, now giving birth to itself again and again between the legs of women. Or maybe it was the Indian hospital in Gallup. The ground still spoke beneath mortar and concrete. She strained against the metal stirrups, and they tied her hands down because she still spoke with them when they muffled her screams. But her body went on talking, and the child was born into their hands, and the child learned to speak both voices. She grew up talking in Navajo and English, and watched the earth around her shift and change, with the people in the towns and in the cities learning not to hear the ground as it spun around beneath them. She learned to speak for the ground, the voice coming through her like roots that have long hungered for water. Her own daughter was born like she had been in either place or all places, so she could leap into the sound she had always heard, a voice like water, like the gods weaving against sundown in a scarlet light. The child now hears names in her sleep. They change into other names and into others. It is the ground murmuring, and Mount St. Helens erupts as the harmonic motion of a child turning inside her mother's belly, waiting to be born to begin another time. And we go on, keep giving birth, and watch ourselves die over and over, and the ground spinning beneath us goes on talking. It's certainly talking now. And this little poem called Break My Heart, it's an Ars Poetica about writing poetry. That's what Ars Poeticas are about. What you look for, or what takes you over, or how it does, and why you keep going, and how we're still here. Break my heart. There are always flowers, love cries, or blood. Someone is always leaving by exile, death, or heartbreak. The heart is a fist. It pockets prayer or holds rage. It's a timekeeper, a music maker, or backstreet truth teller. Baby, baby, baby. You can't say what's been said before, even though words are creatures of habit. You cannot force poetry with a ruler or jail it at a desk. Mystery is blind but wills you to untie the cloth in eternity. Police with their guns cannot enter here to move us off our lands. History will always find you and wrap you in its thousand arms. Someone will lift from the earth without wings. Another will fall from the sky through the knots of a tree. Chaos is primordial. All words have roots here. You will never sleep again, though you will never stop dreaming. The end can only follow the beginning, and it will zigzag through time, governments, and lovers. Be who you are, even if it kills you. It will, over and over again, even as you live. Break my heart. Why don't you? What I look for in a poem. I'm going to read a Los Angeles poem. I was here a few years. I was always in and out going somewhere. I actually commuted to Honolulu, too, while I was here for a while. That's when you could get those real cheap passes for $1,700 unlimited seats on between Los Angeles and Honolulu. It's not like that anymore. But I wound up living on a strange place, right off Hollywood Boulevard for a while. So I'll read these two poems. Because I was wondering what I was doing here. As I'm sure many of you, I'm sure you guys are. Really, I know everybody else thought. I know Wilma Mankiller said, are you okay? Are you having a nervous breakdown? So, but I remember looking outside, and it's called The Path Through to the Milky Way Leads Through Los Angeles. And it does. There are many pathways. There are strangers above me, below me, and all around me, and we are all strange in this place of recent invention. The city name for angels appears naked and stripped of anything resembling the shaking of turtle shells, the songs of human voices on a summer night outside Okmulgee. Yet it's perpetually summer here and beautiful. The shimmer of gods is easier to perceive at sunrise or dusk. When those who remember us here in the illusion of the marketplace turn toward the changing of the sun and say our names, we matter to somebody. We must matter to the strange God who imagines us as we revolve together in the dark sky on the path to the Milky Way. We can't easily see that starry road from the perspective of the crossing of boulevards, can't hear it in the whine of civilization or taste the minerals of planets and hamburgers. But we can buy a map of here of the stars' homes, dial a tone for dangerous love, choose from several brands of water or a hiss of oxygen for gentle rejuvenation. Everyone knows you can't buy love, but you can still sell your soul for less than a song to a stranger who will sell it to someone else for a profit until you're owned by a company of strangers in the city of getting strange and stranger. I'd rather understand how to sing from a crow who was never good at singing or much of anything but finding gold in the trash of humans. So what are we doing here, I ask, crow parading on the edge of falling that hangs over this precarious city. Crow just laughs and says, wait, wait, and see. And I am waiting and not seeing anything, not just yet. But like crow, I collect the shine of anything beautiful I can find. An emergence is where I lived for 2 minutes right off Hollywood Boulevard. And I was living in one room. And again. Emergence. It's midsummer night. The light is skinny. A thin skirt of desire skims the earth. Dogs bark at the musk of other dogs and the urge to go wild. I am lingering at the edge of a broken heart, striking relentlessly against the flint of hard will. It's coming apart. Everyone knows it. So do squash erupting in flowers the color of the sun. So does the momentum of grace gathering allies in the partying mob. The heart knows everything. I remember when there was no urge to cut the land or each other into pieces, when we knew how to think in beautiful. There is no world like the one surfacing. I can smell it as I pace in my square room. The neighbor's television entering my house by waves of sound makes me think about buying a new car, another kind of cigarette, and I don't need another car, and I don't smoke cigarettes. A human mind is small when thinking of small things. It is large when embracing the maker of walking, thinking, and flying. If I can locate the sense beyond desire, I will not eat or drink until I stagger into the earth with grief. I will locate the point of dawning and awaken with the longest day of the world. So this is called, this is a Muskogee rabbit story. It's contemporary. I was thinking I have another poem about being held up over at, what's the name of that park? I was about being held up, and I realized later, I wrote in the poem, but I realized later, and it makes me think about, you know, sometimes we have people who pass and we wonder about how they suffered. But I had a gun up against my head, and I was very careful because I knew I could die at any moment. What was interesting is that at that moment, the reality split, and I realized that I was taken out of my body. And so that helped me. It's funny, it's been years, and I come back to that, and I realize, okay, that helps me to think about that. Anyway, that's just a little side note, and I'm not even reading that poem. Anyway, this is a Muskogee. I'm a member of the Muskogee Creek Nation. Joy Harjo, Chifkados, and Chow Chifkados. And then I'm also a member of Ojibova Ceremonial Ground, or in English, it's Hickory Ground. And Chofi, your rabbit stories are common. And we all have trickster figures. You know, out more in the Southwest, it was Coyote. And then you guys know about Wile E. Coyote, and even Bugs Bunny, another trickster figure, rabbit. And, but we have clowns too. We have clown figures, there are jesters and so on in every society, because they remind us of the worst part of ours, the lessons we need to learn. And you often find them, you often find the trickster sitting somewhere near the seat of power. And they often are there because people who hold power need to be reminded. Because it's easy when you're holding power to start to think that it belongs to you and it's about you, but that's not how it works. If you have some, we all have some kind of power, it is given to you to share. But sometimes people who have amassed great power forget that. And then in the strangest of times, the tricksters wind up sitting in the seat of power. This is called, okay. Rabbit is up to tricks. In a world long before this one, there was enough for everyone until somebody got out of line. We heard it was Rabbit, fooling around with clay in the wind. Everybody was tired of his tricks and no one would play with him, and he was lonely in this world. So Rabbit thought to make a person. And when he blew into the mouth of that crude figure to see what would happen, the clay man stood up. Rabbit showed the clay man how to steal a chicken. The clay man obeyed. Then he showed him how to steal corn, and the clay man obeyed. Then he showed him how to steal someone else's wife, and that clay man obeyed. Rabbit felt important and powerful, and clay man felt important and powerful, and once that clay man started, he could not stop. Once he took that chicken, he wanted all the chickens. Once he took that corn, he wanted all the corn. Once he took that wife, well, he wanted all the wives. He was insatiable. Then he had a taste of gold. He wanted all the gold. Soon it was land or anything else he saw. His wanting only made him want more. Soon it was countries. Then it was trade. The wanting infected the earth. We lost track of the purpose and meaning for life. We began to forget our songs, our stories. We could no longer see or hear our ancestors or talk with each other across the kitchen table. Forests were being mowed down all over the world to make more, and Rabbit had no place left to play. Rabbit's trick had backfired. Rabbit tried to call that clay man back, but when the clay man wouldn't listen, Rabbit realized he'd made a clay man with no ears. Okay. I'm going to read a couple, some from my new collection, An American Sunrise. And I opened the book. I took a position, a chair of excellence at University of Tennessee in Knoxville. And partly, my husband is also Muscogee Creek, and we wanted to go run around our homelands and check out places where we know, you know, where our families came from. We had stories, and that's what we did. And I remember when I was in my interview to be hired, I told them, well, you know, my grandfather, Manahwe, used to steal horses here in Knoxville. They hired me anyway. And it was strange to be in a place that not see our people there. That was the strangest thing, to go home. And we had stories, and like, you know, there was even a house that belonged to a grandfather of mine down there in Columbus, Georgia. That had been his house. A lot of people don't think of it. They think that we were sitting at the edge of the woods, uncivilized, and then, you know, we weren't doing anything. And so, and you know, and they were given the land by God. So it's not how it was. On May 28, 1930, President Andrew Jackson unlawfully signed the Indian Removal Act to force move southeastern peoples from our homelands in the west to the west. We were rounded up with what we could carry. We were forced to leave behind houses, printing presses, stores, cattle, schools, pianos, ceremonial grounds, tribal towns, churches. We witnessed immigrants walking into our homes with their guns, Bibles, household goods, and families taking what had been ours as we were surrounded by soldiers and driven away like livestock at gunpoint. There were many trails of tears of tribal nations all over the North America of indigenous peoples who were forcibly removed from their homelands by government forces. The indigenous peoples who are making their way up from the southern hemisphere are a continuation of the trail of tears. May we all find a way home. And I guess it's a technique of genocide, because one of the survivors of the Trail of Tears, James Scott, says, after our walk, there were no babies left. They killed the babies. So we carry that. America carries that. You know, we carry that in our body, in our story. And I don't think America will fully come into itself until it knows all the story, till all the stories are acknowledged and given a place. So this poem is a story. It's got a story in it. It's like, you know, we all carry parts of it and we have to work them out somehow. My way has been through music and poetry and whatever else I write. I'm working on a second memoir right now. I finally got the opening. So once I have the opening, you know, and I have different parts. But this is one of those moments. Sometimes the burden is too much. Sometimes the burden of history can, we've watched it take people down. And this is about one of those times. It's called Running. It's closing time. Violence is my boyfriend with a cross to bear. Hoisted on by the church, he wears it everywhere. There are no female deities in the Trinity. I don't know how I'm going to get out of here, said the flying fish to the tree. Last call. We've had it with history. We who look for vision here, in the Indian and poetry bar, somewhere to the left of hell. Now I have to find my way when there's a river to cross and no boat to get me there, when there appears to be no home at all. My father gone, chased by the stepfather's gun. Get out of here. I've found my father at the bar. His ghost, at least some piece of him in this sorry place. The boyfriend's convincing to a crowd. Right now he's the spell of attraction. What tales he tells in the fog of thin hope. I wonder this sad world we've made with enemies' words. The lights quiver like they do when the power's dwindling to a dangling string. It's time to go home. We are herded like stoned cattle, like children for the bombing drill. Out the door into the dark street of this old Indian town where there are no Indians anymore. I was afraid of the dark because then I could see. Everything, the truth with its eyes staring back at me, the mouth of the dark with its shiny moon teeth, no words, just a hiss and a snap. I could hear my heart hurting with my in-the-dark ears. I thought I could take it. Where was the party? It's been a century since we left home with the American soldiers at our backs. The party had long started up in the parking lot. He flew through the dark, broke my stride with a punch. I went down and came up. I thought I could take being a girl with her heart in her arms. I carried it for justice, for the rights of all Indians. We all had that cross to bear. The old ones followed me, the quiet girl with the long dark hair, the daughter of a warrior who wouldn't give up. I wasn't ready yet to fling free the cross. I ran and I ran through 2 a.m. streets. It was my way of breaking free. I was anything but history. I was the wind. Well, that one's always a little hard to read. So I was in the middle. We were getting ready to leave south, and the Tennessee River, which was a major roadway for people up through there. And I felt strange because we had come to the homeland and we weren't there, but then we were there. And now we were leaving a place that people fought so hard. You know, my grandfather Manahwi fought in the Battle of Horseshoe Bend against the illegal move. I mean, people laid their lives down to stay home. And here we were going to go back. And I thought, what do I do with this? And the last thing I had time to do is write a book of poetry. That was last on my list. I'm working on a musical that will actually shift the origin story of blues and jazz, or add to the origin story to include Southeastern Native peoples, because we're part of that story. And most people don't know that Congo Square was a Houma or Muskogean village. So you know what happened. Everybody started hanging out and playing music together and setting up booths of food. And, you know, we were part of that story. So I always say when I play blues and jazz, I'm playing also Muscogee Creek music. And, because we're part of it. We're part of the story. Anyway, I stood out. I was working on we have an anthology of Native poetry coming out in August from Norton, the first Norton anthology of Native, full Native poetry, called When the Light of the World Was Subdued, Our Songs Came Through, a Norton anthology of Native Nations poetry. And so we were working on that, and I had students, that was cool, the students got to work on it too, and their names are listed. And I had all this work. One, and then a strange thing, there were three poets in the program, one retired, one died suddenly, and then there was me with all the PhD and MFA students, et cetera. And I was thinking, we're going to leave, and what am I going to... Then the book started coming, this is the first poem of this. It's called How to Write a Poem in a Time of War, because I looked out into these beautiful lands, and I thought, how am I going to write this story? Where do you start? And you know, in poets' research, most people don't know that, but they think we're just these crazy people that get an idea and write it down, and there it is. But there's a lot of work that goes, there's a lot of crafting. I even start revising stuff or shifting because I hear something that still not needs tucked in a little bit. And so this is the first line. There's actually two voices in this poem. It's called How to Write a Poem in a Time of War. And there's two voices, you know, one is kind of observing and one is speaking. And like any poem, I don't know where I'm going. If I do, I can't write it. And I learned something. And this one, I was surprised by what I learned. But I was thinking, too, there's an image of beloved twin girls, and that came from watching what was going on with ISIS in Syria and those in the bombings and those two baby girls that we all saw. We all, you know, those are part of our family too, those people. You can't begin just anywhere, it's a wreck. Shrapnel, in the eye of a house, a row of houses, there's a rat scrambling from light with fleshy trash in its mouth, a baby strapped to its mother's back, cut loose. Soldiers crawl the city, the river, the town, the village, the bedroom, our kitchen. They eat everything or burn it. They kill what they cannot take. They rape what they cannot kill. They take. Rumors fall like rain, like bombs, like mother and father tears swallowed for restless peace, like sunset slanting toward a moonless midnight, like a train blown free of its destination, like a seed fallen where there is no chance of trees or any place for birds to live. No, start here. Deer peer from the edge of the woods. We used to see woodpeckers the size of the sun and were greeted by chickadees with their good morning songs. We'd started to cook outside, slippery with dew and laughter. Ah, these smoky, sweet sunrises. We tried to pretend war wasn't going to happen, though they began building their houses all around us and demanding more. No, not here. You can't begin here. This is memory shredded because it is impossible to hold with words, even poetry. These memories were left here with the trees. The torn pocket of your daughter's hand-sewn dress, the sash, the lace, the baby's delicately beaded moccasin still connected to the foot, a young man's note of promise to his beloved. No, this is not the best place to begin. Everyone was asleep. Despite the distant bombs, terror had become the familiar stranger. Our beloved twin girls curled up in their nightgowns next to their father and me. If we begin here, none of us will make it to the end of the poem. Someone has to make it out alive, sang a grandfather to his grandson, his granddaughter, as he blew his most powerful song into the hearts of the children. Chihoto Chazari Jina Flakari Momais Komet. There. It would be hidden from the soldiers who would take their miles, rivers, mountains from the naval court place of the origin story. He knew one day, far day, the grandchildren would return generations later over slick highways constructed over old trails through walls of laws meant to hamper or destroy, over stones bearing libraries of the winds. He sang us back to our home place from which we were stolen in these smoky hills. Oh, watch can, oh, 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 pay. Yakathlis, holwen. Yes, begin here. Okay. I think I'm going to read this one. I haven't read this one in a while. It's called By the Way. It's a poem for Adrienne Rich. And the New Yorker had to break a rule because they don't allow dedications. That's their policy. But if you take the dedication out of here, it doesn't work. That's kind of interesting. And so we worked at it for a while trying to embed it, but they allowed it. And like I said, we have lots of poetry ancestors and mentors, and I've been lucky. I've had a lot of teachers and mentors in my life, which is sort of where the memoir is going, about the teachers and mentors. And she was one of them. And so I wrote this. I was somewhere outside, not too far from Dulles, somewhere out in there, somewhere at a hotel. And I was thinking about, it wasn't Dulles. Anyway, it was somewhere I was thinking about. I was near where she used to live, I remember, in Massachusetts, and then she moved out to California. So I was thinking about her and missing her in this world, certainly in these times. By the way, so I'm talking to her, as we used to write letters or talk to each other. But I was always intimidated with her. I was always a little intimidated by her and her incredible vision and language, as I should be. By the way, for Adrienne Rich. I've given it time as if time were mine to give. There was a dam larger than Hoover or the president or the patent or the metal creature that sucks up all the dust. Words had to stop and ask permission before crossing over. Oh, sometimes they were wild with the urgency of sweet and leaped. Mostly the rest were kept in the net of swallowed or forbidden language. I want to go back and rewrite all the letters. I lied frequently. No, I was not okay. And neither was James Baldwin, though his essays were perfect spinning platters of comprehension of the fight to assert humanness in a black and white world. That's how blues emerged, by the way. Our spirits needed a way to dance through the heavy mess, the music a sack that carries the bones of those left alongside the trail of tears when we were forced to leave everything we knew, by the way. I constructed an individual life in the so-called civilized world. We all did, far from the trees and plants who had born and fed us. All I wanted was the music, I would tell you now. Within it, what we cannot carry. I talk about then from a hotel room just miles from your home in the east, before you fled on your personal path of tears to the west, that worn-out American dream dogging your steps. You lived on a pedestal for me then, the driven diver who climbed back up from the abyss, Venus on a seashell with a dagger in her hands. I had to look and followed your tracks in the poems cut by suffering, aren't they all? We're in the apocalyptic age of addiction and forgetting. It's worse now. But that dam, I had to tell you, I broke it open stone by stone. It took a saxophone, flowers, and your words had something to do with it. I can't say exactly how. The trajectory wasn't clean, even though it was sure. Does that make sense? Maybe it does only in the precincts of dreams and poetry, not in a country lit for 24 hours a day to keep dreams stuck, turning in a wheel in the houses of money. I read about transcendence, how the light came in through the window of a nearby traveler, and every cell of creation to open its mouth to drink grace. That's what I never told you. I'll read two more. And this one's called An American Sunrise. And it's in a form invented by Terrence Hayes called the Golden Shovel, which takes took a line of Gwendolyn Brooks, and you'll hear the line, I think, by the line endings. An American Sunrise. We were running out of breath as we ran to meet ourselves. We were surfacing the edge of our ancestors' fights and ready to strike. It was difficult to lose days in the Indian bar if you were straight. Easy if you played pool and drank to remember to forget. We made plans to be professional, and some of us could sing. When we drove to the edge of the mountains with a drum, we made sense of our beautiful, crazed lives under the starry stars. Sin was invented by the Christians, as was the devil, we sang. We were the heathens, but needed to be saved from them. Thin chance. We knew we were all related in this story. A little gin will clarify the dark and make us all feel like dancing. We had something to do with the origins of blues and jazz. I argued with the music as I filled the jukebox with dimes in June. 40 years later, and we still want justice. We are still America. We. So I want to say it's good to be back here. I always love this place, and to see some old friends and, of course, make new ones. And this, I guess this series has been going on. I think Stephen Yen's here for 50 years, you said? 50 years. That's pretty good. And... So it takes a lot to put something like this on and then to come out into this basketball traffic. You know, and all that, you know. So thank you, and thank you to the beautiful plants and this place that this building is on. And it's also good to thank the building itself and the walls. It makes a difference. And the plumbing and the lights and the electricity moving through. You know, and the spirit of poetry, which has brought us here together. This is called Equinox. I've had a lot of good teachers, and the thing that they all have in common, the teachers, is one, that they treat everybody the same, and another is that they like sunrise. They know about the power of sunrise. They know that when that sun comes up, you know, that's light. Light is energy. And so they either stay up all night working, whatever it is, and they catch the sun, or they're up at sunrise to say thank you and to share that light in their hearts with, say, they ask, you know, you ask for help for the day and for those, for everyone and for, you know, the people, for the country, for the plants, for this beloved ocean, for all of us, that we make it through. And so I was standing there. I was thinking about this as I stood somewhere in the middle of Michigan waiting to be picked up and standing outside the B&B was a haunted house. And that was kind of a drag. I actually brought this up recently at a reading, and the woman who picked me up from that reading said, that was me, and that place was haunted. And I always wonder, why do people do that? Why do they that's another thing, a rant. Put you in a place they know is haunted. And then they say, well, yeah, we knew it was haunted. Well, then. So I was thinking about that because I was thinking about how it was equinox and about the balancing going on between the sun and the moon energies. And then I was thinking about, yeah, and I was watching dusk. I love dusk. And I was standing there at dusk thinking, well, you know, also there's the other part. At sunrise, you're catching it. There's this movement, you know, toward a culmination. And then at sunset, there's a letting go. So those teachers would also say, you stand there and let things go. You catch that movement. It's helpful. It's like catching waves, you know. It's a certain kind of wave that we're all part of. And then you catch that wave and you let things go and you think, what would happen if every evening at dusk we all let everything go, let go that, you know, I got myself kind of wrapped up for a moment in something, and let it go. Let go what something you knew you should have done but didn't let it go. Let go that thing that you're dragging around from 60 years ago. Let go what you can say things in a poems hold everything. You can hold different kinds of time. You can hold rhythm. You can hold grief. You can hold, that's why people go to poetry. You can hold what we cannot hold with words. You know, let it go, write it down. Let it go in a poem. Let it go, let it go, let it go. So this poem, Equinox, is about thinking about what I needed to let go and at the same time being just grateful for this walk of life, the challenges, the beauty, but also the challenges. I must keep from breaking into the story by force. If I do, I will find a war club in my hand and the smoke of grief staggering toward the sun, your nation dead beside you. I keep walking away, though it has been an eternity. And from each drop of sun springs up sons and daughters and trees, a mountain of sorrows, of songs. I tell you this from the dusk of a small city in the north, not far from the birthplace of cars and industry. Geese are returning to mate, and crocuses have broken through the frozen earth. Soon they will come for me, and I will make my stand before the jury of destiny. Yes, I will answer. In the clatter of the new world, I have broken my addiction to war and desire. Yes, I will reply, I have buried the dead and made songs of the blood, the marrow. Thank you.
So that concludes this week's edition of Dramatext. There was a lecture by Joy Harjo in Los Angeles at the Hammer Museum. Joy Harjo, poet laureate of the United States of America and member of the Muscogee Nation. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation of the spoken word.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gayla Kasla, my name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlaweetsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Wendell exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
This is a poem called The White Judges. We lived in an old schoolhouse, one large room that my father converted into two stories with a plank staircase leading to the second floor. A single window on the south wall created a space that was dimly lit, even at midday. All nine kids and the occasional friend slept upstairs like cadets in rows of shared double beds, ate downstairs in the kitchen near the gas stove, and watched TV near the airtight heater in the adjacent room. Our floors were worn linoleum and scatter rugs. our walls high and bare, except for the family photos, whose frames were crowded with siblings waiting to come of age, marry, or leave.
Saturday, October 16th at The Ritz, Orquesta Criminal returns to the stage, armed with their repertoire of ancient criminal tunes from Moldova, Morocco, Greece, Ukraine, Poland, Argentina, Afghanistan, Russia, and Mexico. Orquesta Criminal is a 10-piece of improv performers interpreting inspired renditions of adventurous gangster songs from a dangerous and forgotten era. Saturday, October 16th at The Ritz, Orquesta Criminal, with special guests, Meduse. Tickets $15 in advance at bluesguysturnblack.com, $20 at the door. Doors at 6:30, a co-presentation of CKUT.
Depuis toujours, les infirmières prennent soin des patients avec cœur et dévouement. Aujourd'hui, c'est à notre tour de prendre soin de ces professionnels en valorisant leurs compétences et en assurant rapidement un meilleur équilibre entre travail et vie familiale. C'est également l'occasion pour les personnes qui ont quitté le réseau public de revenir prêter main forte avec de meilleures conditions. Plus que jamais, nous avons besoin d'elles pour améliorer la vie des patients. Pour en connaître davantage sur notre plan d'action, rendez-vous à québec.ca/infirmière. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Thank you.